in free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It's Friday, July 25th, 2014. I will be returning home on Sunday from the week-long Mises University summer program at the Mises Institute. And so Monday will begin World War I week here on the show. But for today, while I'm out of town, as I've done all week, I've prepared for you an interview that I did with Tom DiLorenzo, an author who's quite popular with listeners of this program, and you'll learn more about Tom in just a minute. But this is an interview I did with Tom when I was hosting the Peter Schiff Show not too long ago. You can listen to the Peter Schiff Show Monday through Friday, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern at schiffradio.com. So let me turn things over right now to my conversation with Tom DiLorenzo. All right, everybody, we are back on the Peter Schiff Show. Tom Woods in for Peter, joined right now by Thomas DiLorenzo, a great hero of mine, an economic historian, economist, historian, all these things put together. He's written, of course, path-breaking revisionist works on Abraham Lincoln. Not allowed to do that, but he went ahead and did it. For example, his book, The Real Lincoln, which was an absolute sensation when it came out over 10 years ago. And right now, in addition to his dozen or so other books, he's got a brand new volume for us called Organized Crime, The Unvarnished Truth About Government. He teaches economics at the former Loyola College, now Loyola University, in Maryland. Tom DiLorenzo, welcome to the Peter Schiff Show.
Hi, Tom. Happy April Fool's Day.
Yeah, thanks. I know it. I don't know what to say about that. There are too many easy jokes. But I want to jump right in here to your book, which came out a little while ago. You talked about it at the Austrian Scholar Economics Research Conference a couple weeks ago or a week or so ago. And this is a book that just covers so much ground in so little space that it seems like you should be charging more for it, in my opinion. But I want to jump right into, for example, you've got six sections in this book, and it's all about different aspects of government, and it takes a revisionist look. It's not what the average person has been taught to believe. And I want to start with an area that I think events have more or less overtaken it, and that is labor unions, because unionism is really going out the door here. I mean, it is on its way out in terms of numbers. But even still, I think kids in school learn a certain series of ideas about unionism, and you are basically teaching the exact opposite. So can you elaborate on this?
Yeah, well, you know, Ludwig von Mises once wrote that the main purveyors of the anti-capitalistic mentality of his day were labor unions. And so if you're wondering why so much effort is being made to keep the whole labor movement mythology going, I think that's one of the reasons for it. And but yeah, you're right. It's only in the private sector, it's only, I think, 6 or 7% of the workforce is unionized. But in the government sector, of course, I think it's more like 55 or 60%. And that seems to be the overwhelming objective of all state and local governments now, is to protect the pay and perks of public employee unions. But in my articles on unions, I guess one of them is called The Inherent Violence of Unions, and it teaches the basic economic lesson that the only way a union could actually increase wages above what you would get on the free market is to somehow prevent competing workers, non-union workers, from competing for the jobs, because after all, if they go on strike, an employer can just hire replacement workers. And so I quoted a big, long study by the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania on the history of union violence in America, and it's something like a 600-page book. And it documents how, for generations, labor unions in America have used murder, mayhem, stoning, stabbing, every kind of violence imaginable perpetrated against non-union workers, not the company. The company is not the main enemy. The main enemy is always the competing workers. And so I just made the point that this is an inherent feature of unions. It's the only way they can keep monopoly wages. And unions are basically labor cartels, but the government exempts them from the antitrust laws, and they're even exempted from a lot of forms of violence that you and I would be prosecuted for, as long as they do it in the name of improving wages and working conditions.
But Tom, we could say, though, that, well, this is all very unfortunate, these aspects of unionism, but the fact is that if we didn't have unions, then employers would have no incentive to pay people more than 10 cents an hour. And so, yeah, we have to take the good with the bad. The unions have, I mean, for example, we had much more unionism in the past, and workers seem to be making more progress than they're making now without unions. So, you know, what would you say to that?
Well, that's a version of the Marxist subsistence theory of wages. It says that employers would only pay the workers just enough to keep them alive and trudging back to the factory every day. But, of course, history disproves that, because wages in America, wages rose by 3 to 5% ever since the Constitution was ratified. And in the post-Civil War years, it stepped up another percentage point or two because of free labor and because of the enormous amount of capital investment that was occurring. And so if you look at history, we see the improvement of wages and working conditions and a reduction in hours worked that happened for generations before unions had any real effectiveness, or before government came in and passed any laws that could codify any of this. And so you need to understand that the main cause, as economics teaches us, of rising wages in history has been capital investment. That increases the marginal productivity of labor, and competition between employers forces employers to offer their best, their productive employees more money, or else they lose them to competitors. It's not that they became charitable, but competition forced them to raise wages in order to compete. And so that is the actual history of the American economy disproves that particular myth about labor unions.
But what if you have a situation like we have now, where there's so many immigrants coming that the supply of labor is so great, then maybe this phenomenon doesn't work out quite as neatly as it would in a more closed labor system?
Yeah, well, what needs to be done, you know, government regulates and taxes capital so much, especially in the era of Dodd-Frank and these other laws that are just destroying capital markets, and the sort of the de facto nationalization of capital markets that has happened is, you know, the way to improve wages of the new immigrants is the same way that the old immigrants had their wages improved. Advances in human capital development, which is education, training, and so forth, and of course the government screws that up badly, but also capital investment in technology. But the more government intervenes in capital markets and in regulation of technology, the slower will be economic growth, and the more difficult it will be for all the new immigrants to make a decent living.
Tom, we were a little late in getting you on. Will you be able to stay over into the next segment?
Sure.
Okay. All right. So we've got about, let's say I gave you a minute. Could you, in 1 minute, refute a bumper sticker I saw about the weekend brought to you by labor unions?
I don't know. The only way you can make more money and work fewer hours is through increased productivity. And the main cause of increased worker productivity is capital investment. And so that, in a sense, it's the workers who free ride on the risk-taking and investments of the capitalists.
So if anything, yeah, right. So my view on this has been that if they're going to make an argument like this, then if anything, it could be turned against the left, that if anything, the workers should be paying a kickback to the owners for investing in the capital, right? So
they
wouldn't,
they should at least be grateful for it and don't believe the union propaganda that spews hatred toward their employers, the source of their affluence.
Right, because I deal with a lot of people who say that labor is the fundamental ingredient in production, and so they deserve an extra subsidy, and I would say, well, but if it was just them working with their bare hands, they sure wouldn't produce a whole heck of a lot. All right, Tom, stand by for a minute. I want to come back at the other side of this break. There's so much to talk about in organized crime. What about under free markets, monopolies will swallow us all up. We'll all be dead because the monopolists will be at our throats. How do we deal with that? That's next on the Peter Schiff Show. Welcome, everybody, to the second hour of the Peter Schiff Show. Tom Woods filling in for Peter today. Joined by Thomas DiLorenzo, professor of economics at Loyola University in Maryland, author of, I think it's over a dozen books at this point, and we're talking in particular today about his most recent book, Organized Crime, The Unvarnished Truth About Government. Tom, I chose these topics just that we would talk about, even though there are a gazillion in your book, just because I think they're the ones that school children are most likely to hear repeated. And so I think the topic that you've done so much important pioneering work on is antitrust. And this is one of these areas people think, well, surely this is an intervention we need. Maybe we need to reform it a little bit, but obviously the free market, as Marx said, is going to lead to greater and greater concentrations of wealth, and the rest of us will be mere peons. How do you deal with people who are stuck in that kind of mentality?
Yeah, well, the Fed and antitrust are like two things that most people know nothing at all about, although Ron Paul did a great service in educating millions about the Fed. But the standard story that everyone is told is that in the late 19th century, the American economy was becoming rampantly monopolized, and the government came to the rescue with the Sherman Antitrust Act in 1890 to regulate these monopolies and protect us consumers from monopoly. And that always sounded like a fishy story to me. So I published an article in an academic journal called the International Review of Law and Economics way back in 1984. And I showed in that article that the industries that were being accused of monopolizing industry were cutting prices several times faster than the price level was falling at the time. This was a period of price deflation. And also they were expanding production, some of them 10 times faster than GDP, for an entire decade prior to the 1890 Sherman Antitrust Act. So what was going on was a targeting of the most productive, the most dynamic, the most competitive industries in America by the sour grapes losers who could not compete, and they simply ran to politics. They ran to the government to try to do something about these falling prices and expanding output and the invention of new products. So antitrust was a protectionist law from the very beginning. And, there have been many books written about antitrust regulation by economists for 110, 115 years. They say it hasn't really worked out too well. It's been counterproductive. But part of the myth is that, at the beginning it was a good idea. Well, I think I've pretty much proved that, no, it was never a good idea. It was always a protectionist racket, just exactly the opposite of what school children are taught, if they're taught anything at all about it.
Well, what about more recent history? I mean, can you think of some more recent examples of? I mean, I think antitrust has retreated a bit, the antitrust establishment, yeah, partly because of the work that you and Dom Armentano have done. I don't think it's as bad or as unreasonable as it used to be, and yet maybe I'm wrong about that.
You're right. It's not. I think thanks to scholarship that has been taking place for the past 30 years or more, that the antitrusters have taken a step back. You know, late in the Carter administration, it was so out of control that the Democrat-controlled Congress actually defunded the Federal Trade Commission because it was doing such outrageous things. And so, you're right about that. But look at the Microsoft antitrust case. The Microsoft Corporation was investigated for 4 years by the Bush administration, and they found that they were doing nothing wrong. And then they had the Federal Trade Commission look at them, and then the Justice Department look at them. And they finally went and sued Microsoft. But then what happened was the Microsoft's competitors were revealed or outed as being behind the lawsuit. They hired all these consultants, including Robert Bork, the late Robert Bork, who was very well known in the field, and they actually constructed the actual case that was put against Microsoft by the government. But then in the end, the judge in the case was so biased that he was kicked off the case by the three panel of federal judges that appointed him because he was so biased. He actually gave a magazine interview where he compared Bill Gates, founder of Microsoft, to Al Capone. But the government, to save face, made them pay a small penalty, and that was the end of it.
Our guest is Tom DiLorenzo, author of Organized Crime, The Unvarnished Truth About Government. When you look at the different topics you've got in here. I mean, it's all politically incorrect, fun stuff, like the myth of the male-female wage gap, the myth of government job creation, and so on and on, all the way to the myth of the independent Fed, how central banking hides the cost of war. I mean, this is stuff you're not supposed to be taught. But let's hit a little bit, though, on this male-female wage gap thing, because you had Walter Block come speak at your university, and he said some politically incorrect things about the male-female alleged wage gap, and he got into some trouble. And then when he got back to his home university, where everybody was yelling at him for saying these things, he challenged anyone in the whole university to come debate him. And of course, every one of them is a coward. So instead, he just gave a public lecture on it, and no one dared to question him.
Right. He gave a very mainstream lecture. You know, Walter Block was a student of Gary Becker at Columbia University many years ago. He was his dissertation advisor. And Gary Becker's doctoral dissertation in Chicago was entitled The Economics of Discrimination. So Walter Block's lecture at my university was very mainstream about the male-female wage gap primarily. And, you know, basically if you control for such things as marriage, which affects men and women differently, and choice of occupation and age and education and experience, then the wage gap is very minimal, very, very small. He didn't say there's no such thing as wage discrimination or misogynists don't exist in the world or anything like that. But the standard economics of this is that if there is exploitation of women in wages, it provides a profit opportunity for competing employers. If a woman can work for you and produce $100,000 a year in revenue, but you pay her $10,000, well, it's worth your competitor's while to offer her $20,000, $30,000, or $50,000, and he'll still make a big profit by having her working for you. So Walter Block explained and gave a really state-of-the-art lecture on this topic. And but what he did was he ruffled the feathers of the politically correct academic establishment, because, you know, one of their chief superstitions is that racism and sexism are immutable. They are unchangeable, and they explain everything in society, including all the wage differences between men and women. And the president of my university, Brian Lemaine, actually committed a huge act of libel. He libeled Walter Block by sending out an email to all the faculty, students, and alumni apologizing for the insensitivity. He used the word insensitivity of Walter Block, but he did not say what Walter Block said that was insensitive, because, of course, he was not at the lecture. And so that's how the Marxian multiculturalists, as they call themselves, behave in academia today.
And of course, if this really were just a matter of bad men just don't want to hire women, and somehow the good men don't realize, well, wait a minute, I could save 30% hiring women if I just did that. I mean, even assuming that were plausible, how can you possibly account for the fact that there basically is no male-female wage gap with single never-married women and single never-married men? When you compare apples and apples, you don't compare men with women who have been out of the labor force and now half their experience is they're rusty, or it's no longer relevant, or there are whole fields they can't enter because they can't interrupt that field for pregnancy. You know, how could it be? Is that just a great coincidence?
Yeah, well, I have no trouble explaining this to the female students in my undergraduate classes, the 19 and 20-year-old female students. I ask them, well, say you and, you know, Joe sitting next to you here both graduate with a degree in accounting, you both pass the CPA exam, get the exact same score, and you go out and work for 5 or 6 years, and then Joe keeps at it working for the accounting firm, but you have 3 children, and you drop out of the labor force for 10 years, and then you go back your accounting job, would you be expected to be paid exactly the same as Joe, who has 10 years more experience than you? And of course not. They all think it would be grossly unfair if they came back and were paid the same as Joe. And that's all Walter Block was saying. But like I said, you know, it's part of the politically correct mantra. You can't even bring this up, that the people were outraged that anyone would suggest that anything but discrimination could possibly account for wage differences, and it really is an ignorant point of view and an attack on academic freedom. But, you know, in today's academic world, I really looked into this. I was wondering, you know, how did the Jesuits, I teach at a Jesuit school, go from champions of academic freedom to censors? And they're basically followers of the Marxist Herbert Marcuse, a well-known academic, who postulated back in the 60s that only the oppressed in society deserve free speech. And, of course, the oppressors do not. And so he provided a justification for the crackdown on free speech on college campuses in the name of sort of the pop Marxism. And so that's what we face today in the academic world.
Well, Tom, unfortunately, we're out of time, but I want to thank you for your time today and, of course, for this great book and all your great books. I appreciate you being here.
My pleasure, and have a great day.
All right, everybody, that's Thomas DiLorenzo, author of most recently of Organized Crime, The Unvarnished Truth About Government. All right, that's my chat with Tom. Another week has come and gone on the show, and I want to thank you guys, as always, for helping me out, helping me pay the bills here, helping me to promote the show, giving me a budget to promote the show by making your Amazon purchases at TomWoodsRadio.com, entering Amazon through the widget at TomWoodsRadio.com. At no cost to yourself, you help keep the show going. And, of course, you can become a supporting listener at SupportingListeners.com and get all kinds of goodies. But whatever way you help the show, it is deeply appreciated. All right, World War One week begins on Monday. We'll see you then.
The Tom Woods Show.